or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
I mean, this show probably today should be called Philosophy Talk. It's about the meaning of life. Esquire magazine put out a two-book series in which they interviewed 100 people and asked them various questions about the meaning of their life and what causes it. And, of course, my wife, Barbara Nemko, and I have read, there were two volumes, I read one, she read the other, and we picked out some of the bon mots that are perhaps have maximum implications for you, or at least worthy of brief discussion. So, without further ado, let me introduce the Napa County Superintendent of Schools and my wife, Dr. Barbara Nemko. Welcome, as usual, to the show.
Good morning.
Hi. So, why don't I be a gracious host and let you go first? Start with one of the people who were profiled in the Meaning of Life book that you want to share a couple of bon mots about.
Well, as a typical wife, I'm not going to do what you just asked.
Of course not.
I'm going to start with the person who conducted the interview, conducted 25 of the 65 interviews in the book that I looked at.
Okay.
Because I was just so struck by his comment, which is not earth-shattering, and yet it is. He said, when listening to somebody, look him in the eye as if he is the only person in the world. And the reason that struck me so much is over the last 25 years, twice I've had the opportunity to meet Hillary Clinton in person. And there is nobody better at doing that. And it's a profound experience because so few people do it. We look at a person and then our eyes are scanning the room to see who else is there or what else is going on. And she makes you feel so important that you have to just fall in love with her.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great point, and I learned it from you telling me about that. And now, when you know, it is so tempting when you're at a party or a group get-together, especially if you're talking to somebody who is not the most important person on your priority list, to be scanning the room. And all that does is it makes the person feel like crap for no reason. You can always cut the conversation short by, at the appropriate moment, sticking your hand out and saying it was good talking with you, and with a little smile, and that way the person doesn't feel demeaned, and you're still able to get out and go and talk to somebody else.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, but it's not easy. I think that's why it hit me so powerfully.
It's a good point. I'm really glad you didn't listen to me. You're always right when you don't listen to me. So,
hardly.
So instead of my giving you any more recommendations, what the hell do you want to do right now?
I'm going to tell you that Robert De Niro said something similar.
Okay.
He said Martin Scorsese listens. He's open to unexpected things on that. This is a flowery way of saying it on that voyage. He takes ideas, and he's not afraid to try them. I think listening is one of those skills that really should be taught and practiced so much more in school. We assume that everybody knows how to listen because we listen all the time, but most of us don't. Mm-hmm. And the notion that we need to stop our mind from wandering. Someone's talking to you, and you're thinking about where you're going next, what you have to do, the grocery list, where your kids are. And you're not paying attention. This is why so many of us don't remember someone's name 3 seconds after they were introduced, because we never really listened.
Here I only have to partially agree. There is a time to fully listen, and that is especially if something is complicated and that you're not going to get it. But very often intelligent people do know exactly where the person is going, and especially if the person who's talking is long-winded. They can take 3 minutes to say what could have been said in 10 seconds. And it is a very good use of time when you make a judgment that you know exactly where the person's going, to do something about what are you going to say next, what could you ask, etc. I think these blanket one-size-fits-all rule about never let your mind wander, always listen, never interrupt, I think are wrong. I think the issue is to be more conscious, to say, okay, is this a time where I really do need to make sure I'm not distracted? Is this a time when I should interrupt? What do you think?
You'll be shocked. I'm going to agree with you.
Great.
It's obvious because I don't do that so often.
Right. Continue on. What else you got from...
No, but I don't want to just leave that. I think the point is that most of us probably most of the time don't listen. It's not that we're making a conscious judgment, I'm listening to this one, but I'm not listening to that one, he's got nothing to say. We're just not listening. Our minds are distracted so much of the time. So you need to at least listen long enough to know if he's not worth listening to.
Right. Well, I was listening very carefully to the quote you just read from De Niro, and the tagline of that was,
right.
he said that Scorsese is willing to take risks and try stuff.
Right.
Well, you know, again, that I love, one of the reasons I love public radio is it's about nuance, and I want to add some nuance to De Niro's statement about Scorsese. You know, it's easy to take risks when you're worth $100 million, you're the boss, you're in charge. The risk-reward ratio of him screwing up is zero. He could take a risk on a movie and lose $50 million, and it wouldn't change his bank account in any significant way. For the rest of people who are schnooks, who are working for demand, and have to, if you dare take a risk in saying, I disagree with you, Mr. Boss, or let's try this innovation and I'm going to really push for it, and then it blows up, you're fired and you don't have a $100 million bank account to afford the risk. So isn't really the question of take, that's a really perfect example in my mind of why we shouldn't listen to famous people's advice, because their situation is so different from ours that they are out of touch with what's really practical advice for the rest of the world.
Well, I'm going to go back to what you said earlier. There is no one-size-fits-all.
Exactly.
In some ways, it's riskier for the guy who's got $100 million because when he takes a risk and it's terrible, the headlines are, he bombed. It's not a quiet little, oh, my goodness. It's he bombed and he lost $100 million, and then he's got to rebuild his reputation.
But he ain't going to be homeless. He's not going to... I'm sorry. He's not going to be homeless. He's not going to be devoid of options. He's going to still live in his compound in Malibu. Whereas if an employee who works for a radio station dares to disagree, for example, with the station manager, he could be out of a job, or she, of course, could be out of a job in a nanosecond. And then it ain't so easy to get a job in radio, for just an example.
But if you never listen and take an idea, and if you are always paralyzed by fear that, oh, my God, if I try this, who knows what will happen, then you never get to the point where you can be very successful. And I think a number of other people that I read in here will talk about that, so we may get to those.
Okay, yep.
There's one more that he said. It's not exactly work-related, but it's so important. I hope that the listeners won't mind if I say it.
Great.
He said, when a parent dies, it's the end. I always wanted to chronicle the family history with my mother. She was always interested in that. Mm. I wanted some researchers I worked with to talk with my mother, but my mother was a little antsy about it. Mm. I know she would have gotten into it, and it would have been okay with my father, but I wasn't forceful, and I didn't make it happen. Mm. That's one regret I have. I didn't get as much of the family history as I could have for the kids. And I feel that way. I think there were so many stories I heard over the years, but I didn't really sit down and ask questions, and I certainly didn't write it down, never assuming that my memory would not be so perfect that I would not remember every word. So I think if your parents are still alive, it's a great time to ask some of the questions and get it written down so you can pass it on.
I think it's a legitimate point. I'd like to disagree 25%. We have this as an article of faith that our interest in family should be greater than interest in other people. But who is our family is an act of biological happenstance. And yes, we end up spending a lot of time with them. But who is to say that it is a better use of our time to dig into the deep questions with our family members than perhaps the human being whom we most respect? There's only a certain amount of time. You're not going to dig into everybody. But I would argue that if I were going to spend some time trying to dig into someone's life and the lessons learned or what's important or whatever, I would rather talk, and that's why I love, one of the reasons I love doing this radio show, I get to talk with some of the people who I volitionally, who I choose, who I think are some of the most interesting people with lessons for all of us. Whereas my family is my family. You know, my mom, you know, was an okay person, but... You know, can I really say, when I listened back recently to my interview with Alan Dershowitz on this show, what an interesting guy. How much I learned from Alan Dershowitz. about the art of argumentation, of rhetoric, of thinking. You know, I'm not going to get anything near. My mom was just your typical fairly materialistic person whose world or sphere of influence and interest was in singing and dancing and laughing and making jokes and spending money on clothing. This isn't, you know. So why is it that it's always seen as wiser to take a greater interest in somebody because of the biological accident that they happen to share our DNA?
Because you only have two parents, and they raised you. So it helps to explain why they did, what they were thinking, what decisions they made, and then to think about how that may have affected you, and to be able to understand where you came from, because that's where you came from. There are two people. You can choose any one of the billions of people on the planet any other time. Interviewing these two people and knowing about your roots are not in any way going to preclude you interviewing all the smart, wonderful, fabulous people that you're interested in.
As a human being, I certainly agree. I'm an emotional person, and I care emotionally, irrationally, more about my mom and my dad than I do about Alan Dershowitz. But we're not necessarily a slave to our emotions. And given that we don't have time to interview everyone, and given that we have like an X time, let's say we're allocating 2 hours, would I not, for example, the person I want to talk about in volume one of this, The Meaning of Life, is Michael DeBakey, the heart surgeon. Imagine if I had a choice, I mean, to spend that discretionary hour interviewing Michael DeBakey, the guy who pioneered heart transplants, or my mother. You know, even if I don't have insight into myself, who am I? Am I really that important? I'm merely a speck. I'm one of 7.7 billion people on the planet. Why is it really so important for me to understand my roots? In fact, so often people who are in psychotherapy and they look at the childhood roots of their problems, they end up blaming their parents and things that can't be changed. Is it really not more constructive to be focusing on people like Michael DeBakey and millions of others than my mother?
I think you're carrying this to a real extreme. The 1 hour that you would have interviewed your mother,
that's not my point,
would not have in any way stopped you from interviewing 17 Michael DeBakeys and learning all about them. And nobody is talking about putting you into psychotherapy because you interviewed anybody and perseverating on it. It's just nice. And when your kids ask you, well, what about this? What about grandma and what about grandpa? And you don't know the answers, it's too bad.
Of course, for an hour, there's
no
argument about it.
I think that we've kind of
one more second. There's no arguing about the hour, but the point really is, and we don't think of, and this has relevance to our work lives. We don't realize the notion that time is our most valuable commodity. It is the most valuable product, and we have choices. We don't have time to do everything. No one could argue about an hour spending talking to your mother. Come on,
but you are.
But we're talking about the larger issue of how many people do prioritize. Remember, I did broaden the discussion from the 1 hour to how many people do prioritize focus on family. And for example, we had dinner last week with somebody who spends weeks, hours writing a book about her, him. Well, we're talking about some hours, weeks writing a memoir about his family. Is that really necessary? Are we not prioritizing blood over? Are we not giving disproportionate weight to blood in terms of our own growth, in terms of our own learning, in terms of our own contribution to the world?
And when his book becomes a bestseller, then we'll decide that.
All right. Let's turn to, you had talked about some of the lessons of life from the book, The Meaning of Life, Volume 2. In Volume 1, the one that I'd like to start by talking about, and then I'd like to hear your reaction, of course, to that is Michael DeBakey, the heart surgeon. And here are a few of his quotes. Here's the first of four quotes that I'd like to mentioned from Michael DeBakey's interview, and I'm curious as to reactions. He says, quote, I've done more than 60,000 heart operations. So by the way, I should let our listeners know, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. We are discussing the two-volume set that was put out by Esquire magazine called The Meaning of Life, in which they interviewed over 100 people, and we're picking out the little snippets that have the greatest implications for your work life especially. And so I'm now talking about Michael DeBakey's interview, and he said, quote, I've done more than 60,000 heart operations. I used to start operating at 6 in the morning. Sometimes I wouldn't finish until 10 or 11 at night. I've been fortunate in that I need very little sleep. By the way, he was 90-something when he was interviewed for this. I can get along well on 4 or 5 hours. What's your reaction? We live in a world of where work-life balance is deified. Here is this guy who believes he's done a lot more good for the world because he has worked, you know, 12, 15 hours a day doing heart operation because he was the greatest in that sphere. Should he be dubbed a workaholic? Should he be cheered as a hero? What are your thoughts about him, work-life balance, and all the rest of it?
I think it's an isolated quote. Did he do that 7 days a week? We don't know.
Yeah,
that. Did
60,000.
He 3 days a week?
He said 60,000. He did 60,000 surgeries.
But he's 98, so I'd like to know how many years. I mean, I don't think that one can judge. There are some people who like to work very intensely while they're in the zone, and maybe he worked from 6 in the morning until 10 at night. Frankly, if he worked from 6 in the morning until 10 at night, I'm not sure I would have wanted him operating on me the next morning at 6 o'clock. And I wonder if they did a study of whether there was any difference in the success rate of the 60,000 operations. So I don't know. I mean, it clearly, he was a hard worker, and clearly he did a lot of good for mankind.
He was legendary, actually.
Humankind.
He lived to be 100, by the way. Okay, next. His next quote is, I scheduled my last operation when I was 90. I had, at that point, and that point only, did I feel I had done enough and should turn it over to my colleagues. That gives to the question about retirement and when to pass it on to the next generation. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, obviously, I'm not a big fan of early retirement.
Well, you're way too young for that, but I mean, go ahead.
I think it depends on what you do and how you feel about it. There are people who should retire early because they hate what they do, and they only do it because they feel they need to make, or they not feel, they obviously need to make a living. But when you're doing something and you feel negative about it and you're dragging yourself to work every day, if you can possibly afford to retire, go for it, because you're kind of a drain on the workforce. Yeah. But for people who love what they do and find it challenging, then retirement because you reach a certain age has got to be the silliest thing ever.
Right.
Why would you want to stop doing something where you're making a difference and doing good and it makes you feel good?
I agree with most of what you say. I disagree with a little of it, which is that the criterion should be whether you love what you do. And again, maybe I'm being too, sanctimonious here. But some of it also requires some reflection as to how good you do. Let's say I loved being a heart surgeon. I really still love it. But, you know, maybe I'm not quite as quick, and so it's taking longer to do the surgeries, therefore putting my patients at risk. They're under anesthesia longer. Or my hands aren't quite as shaky. Or I haven't kept up with the literature. Is it not, even if I love it, is it not my obligation, really a cosmic obligation, to look inward and ask myself two questions? Number one, would my patients, my clients, my coworkers, society, be better off if I kept going? Or if I retired, which also yielded the additional advantage of giving a younger person a shot. That, I guess that's one question. What's your reaction to that? That loving it or not is not the core factor. It's also at least need to be considering all these more external factors about what would be right for the world.
Obviously, if you can't do the job well anymore, then you shouldn't be doing it. But we're talking about people who think that at age 62, they need to retire because they've reached retirement.
That's crazy. Yes, that's the part I agree with you. Yeah.
Because all of these retirement ages were set many years ago when people didn't live as long and didn't live as healthy, maybe it made sense then. It makes absolutely no sense now. Nobody should decide retirement based on a number. They should decide retirement on whether they enjoy what they're doing and they feel fulfilled by it. And obviously, if your hand is shaky and you're a heart surgeon, yeah, get out of the operating room.
Right.
But most of us don't do that kind of work.
This I agree with completely. I just want to amplify it just another moment. You know, we are both over 50, and so we know a lot of people in their 50s and 60s, and it's amazing, and 70s, and it's amazing the range. There are some people who are 55 and look like they're washed up, even, you know, cognitively, physically, motivationally. They're washed up at 55. 75. And there are others who are 73 who are fully vital and should be working another 15 years. So it's not a chronological thing. It really is. There's enormous variability in people's ability to be excellent. It also depends on your field. I'm looking at David Latulippe. I really like him, my board operator engineer. Now, he's a wonderful flutist. I know that there are some flutists who can play in their 70s and 80s because they've kept in shape, their breath control is great, and others who allowed themselves to get fat and didn't develop and don't have the good breath control who should be out of there at 55. So it's also going to depend on what career.
They might have should have been out at 45.
Well, anyway, let me read another quote from Michael DeBakey. Again, those of you who are just joining us, you listen to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. We are discussing the wonderful two-volume set of books published by Esquire magazine called The Meaning of Life, in which they interviewed over 100 people. And I'm now picking a few quotes from the interview of Michael DeBakey and asking Barbara to react. Here he talks about, he says, quote, being compassionate, being concerned for your fellow man, doing everything you can to help people, that's the kind of religion I have, and it's a comforting religion. I don't get involved in discussions of intelligent design. Yeah, you can't answer those questions for anyone, so why fool with them? What are your thoughts about the role of religion, whether it be a secular religion, which he's describing as compassion, or religion per se, as it affects the workplace? You are in a workplace in Napa. Napa is a more religious community than, for example, Oakland or Berkeley tends to be. What, if any, role does some kind of spirituality or religion, in your judgment, have in your workplace, and what, if any, should it have?
I don't really think religion should have a place in the workplace. Religion tends to polarize, although certainly celebrations are nice, and I think we can all get behind celebrations of different groups. I think it's lovely that we celebrate things like Christmas and Chinese New Year and anything else that anybody wants to celebrate by saying, let's do such and such, and if you want to come, you can come. But to require any kind of religion in the workplace, it's not even a topic
not
I
require,
think about.
What I want to argue for is the spirituality, whether it is God-based, that would in case of religion, or simply cosmic justice-based, or it seems to me it's critical that there be some of that spiritual foundation, and I'm going to define spiritual in a minute, behind every single human being in every single workplace. And that is a sense of always thinking foundationally. You know, not just, oh, I've got this task to do, am I going to do it, which often is there, but constantly asking themselves, what is, either if you're a religious person, what would God think the right thing is? And whatever your religion, whether it be Judaism, Christianity, you know, Muhammad, Islam, whatever, all of the basic teachings are certainly good ways to live life in general, not all, but most of them. And, you know, whether it's based in the, you know, in the Bible or the Quran, or in a sense of secular humanism, it seems like if that can undergird everything, people will be both kinder to each other, more ethical, they're not going to screw each other. It seems to me that that ethical foundation really does belong at the centerpiece, at the hub of every work experience. Do you disagree?
Yes. I think ethics, obviously, kindness, compassion are important. I don't call those religion. I don't call those spirituality.
Okay. Last thing on Michael DeBakey, and then I want to turn back to you and have you talk about some of your favorite quotes from the people interviewed for The Meaning of Life. Michael DeBakey, the world-famous heart surgeon, wrote, "The worst thing, of course, and you're never quite prepared for it, is when the patient dies during the operation. You die a little every time that happens." So that the larger question for all of us in the workplace is failures. We all have major failures. I'm not talking about the little minor failures. I think about a major failure I have, and then I want to hear one that you have and how we deal with it. So, for example, there have been a number of cases in my 4,800 career counseling clients where I gave the wrong advice. I either encouraged them to aim too high or I encouraged them to aim too low, and it was wrong. or I decided to be tough on them and they crumbled, or I decided to be nice, really nice, and a cheerleader, and it all it did was enable them to keep procrastinating. And when the client then, I check with them back 6 months later and their life is the same or worse, or they're furious at me because I was too tough or too easy or overestimated or underestimated. I mean, I never tell people what to do, but my advice was too optimistic or pessimistic. A little of me dies too. Barbara, can you talk about some of your, not trivial, significant failures and how the hell you deal with it? Because I just feel crappy about it, but I try to just suppress it and not think about it and say, what the hell, maybe I can learn something, maybe I can't from it, and I'm going to move on. Tell me about, if you can, one or more of real failures that you've had and how you dealt with it.
Well, my was probably in a hire for an important position in the office. The person was recommended highly by a number of people, and during the interview process, there were doubts, and we definitely should have said, okay, nobody in this candidate pool is really right, and gone out again and looked for somebody, but I didn't. I kind of pushed for this person because of all the recommendations that I'd gotten. And sometimes you're in the Peter principle. The person has risen to the level where they can no longer succeed, and that was the case here. And it was a number of years before we even realized how messed up things were. And what we did is we tried to negotiate the person leaving.
You can't just fire people anymore. It's a whole negotiation process.
Firing people is very difficult today.
Right. So what would you do now if you had to hire for a very important position that might be lessons for all of us who are in a position to hire, whether you're a first-line supervisor or you're the CEO like you are? What is a not obvious critical thing that you would do differently in light of that to hire a wonderful person?
Well, clearly don't feel that you're obligated to choose one out of the initial pool if you don't get the right person or you have doubts. If you have doubts, then you absolutely need to go and talk with lots more people and really delve into the job that the person was doing. And if this is a job that's at a higher level than what they were doing before, I would try again. I would get another pool of candidates.
I would like
because
to
the mm-hmm. what it costs you is so big,
right,
compared to that.
Huge. I would like to invite the listeners to weigh in. If you've been listening to our discussion about the meaning of life as described by some of the world's most eminent folks, I'll be talking about Salman Rushdie for a minute. We talked about Michael DeBakey, the famous heart surgeon. We talked about Robert De Niro. If you have any thoughts about anything that we said and want to contribute to the conversation, either agree, disagree, or amplify, all perspectives intelligently presented and are welcome, or even not so intelligently presented. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Barb, so who is the next person in your volume two of The Meaning of Life, whose quotes you would like to get my reactions to?
Faye Dunaway.
Faye Dunaway. Okay,
yep.
Go ahead.
She said, when someone is successful, there's always a feeling that they were lucky.
Mm.
Luck plays a part, sure, but to be successful, you must have iron discipline. You need energy and hunger and desire and honesty.
Nothing else but to say. It's true. Luck matters. It does. The older I get, the more I believe. You know, I used to think if you work hard enough, you can get anything, but there is a lot of luck who you happen to meet. Yes, you increase your chances by hang around with people who can be of help, and there's timing. You know, I love the story of the invention of the television. It was invented in 1929, but the world wasn't ready for it yet. So it was amazing, a step forward as the television was. It was 20 years, and the guy who invented it got essentially nothing for his inventing the television. So there is luck, but yes, luck, there are people who work hard end up with better luck. That's fairly unarguable. What else you got?
Richard Branson.
Okay. This is the guy who's the Virgin Atlantic, Virgin Records,
rather
Virgin guy.
Rather successful business person.
I would say. And I wish I had his hair.
Try to avoid falling out with people. The world is a very small place. I'm finding that over and over and over again, that I'm running into people that I knew 30 years ago, and they're in different, obviously we're all in different positions now, but they're still here, and there is absolutely no reason to to leave people with negative feelings about you, because you never know where they're going to pop up in your life again.
Again, I only partly agree. You know, there is a time to stand up and let somebody be angry at you. I know somebody who, for example, was fired because his or her political views were politically incorrect, but certainly well-intentioned. And there is a real argument. Is it possible that he should just go quietly so he keeps that bridge open? Or is it right, as in the previous show, Philosophy talked about the importance of standing up for what you believe as core being a rebel or a revolutionary. Is there not a place for somebody to say, the heck with it, yes, I'm going to burn that bridge. And again, it's maybe to my selfish detriment, but damn it, I feel I need to, you know, hit him between the eyes, because maybe I'll have planted a seed that may change his views about his unbelievable censorship of views that aren't politically correct. What do you think?
I think one size doesn't fit all. Obviously, you're not going to 100% never leave anybody with a bad feeling. But for the most part, you can structure your life so that people feel good about you. They're happy when they see you. It makes life so much easier, so much more pleasant, and helps you to get ahead.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. We do have calls on the line. So welcome to Work with Marty Nemko and Barbara Nemko. It is your turn on the air. What is on your mind?
Hey, you just reminded me of something a boss said many years ago, what you just said about, making a stand with your thing. And he said his point was, when you had a reluctant customer, you know, this is in sales, but sounds similar. He called it the method of turn 'em or burn 'em. Where someone, where you come on so strong and make all your points, you either convince them of what you're saying, or you've burned them out, and that's it. You're going to move on to something else.
So you're saying that you
can earn a method.
So you're saying that with customers, certainly is time. You know, give it your best shot, even if they're alienated. So you lose them. Big deal is your point.
Well, in other words, after you've tried the normal sales methods and they're just kind of languishing in a folder, like, oh, four people have tried to sell him and he's not going to buy, you come on super strong, and then you, if you don't get anywhere, you close the folder out. Okay, we're done with that.
Okay.
Prospect.
Yeah. And of course, as Barbara is saying, that's a one size does not. With a customer, doesn't matter. There's always another customer. Generally.
Sure. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is, as far as role models or people, you know, a Richard Branson to me is like trying to follow the path of an astronaut going to the moon.
Exactly.
It's like, that's so beyond anything I have a path to.
Yeah, Kevin, that's exactly what we talked about earlier. The notion of generalizing from the experiences of these bizarrely famous people, because we adore celebrity culture, is ridiculous, because what works for Robert De Niro or Richard Branson ain't going to work for Marty Nemko or anybody, you know, who's in the real world.
Right, and so the lesson that I followed was, when I had to be a trainee in a dispatcher program for a 911 emergency center, there were people who were very good and very fast, partly because they could do their tasks at like 90 words a minute. I can't do that, but yet there was an older worker who was pushing 70, still in the job after 30 years, who was a fairly slow typist and even typed with one hand, yet he could get his calls out just as effectively. And so I'm looking at him and going, wow, that's more like I feel at my beginner stage. If I copy him, then I'm still able to do the job, but it's a reachable thing. I don't have to be a 6'8" basketball player.
Yeah, I love slow and steady guys, and women, of course, are my really very favorite. I love telling the story of when I was a teenager, I was a musician and I made a lot of money. And I didn't. And though in those days, what you did with it, you went to the stockbroker. You went to Merrill Lynch. So I went into the Merrill Lynch office in Queens, New York, and there was a room of like 50 cubicles, each with a separate broker. And you, at that point, you could pick whoever you wanted. And I saw about 49 of them frantically fast working in front of their computers, blah 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 blah. And there was one guy who seemed much calmer. And that was the guy I went to, and he was one of their most successful brokers. He was a slow and steady guy. His name was Bob Corwin. And so, right, you don't have to be the biggest, the fastest, whatever. There are more one ways to be at least good enough. Yeah. Anyway, I want to thank you very much for the call. Barbara, anything you want to add to that, or should we move to your next quote that you'd like to share?
Well, I don't think anybody will disagree with this one.
Okay. Who's it from?
An artist, Chuck Close, and he says, if you're overwhelmed by the whole, break it down into pieces.
Right. It's the oldest rule in the book, and we tend to dismiss it because it's such a cliche. But in the end, if I had to look back at all my career counseling clients and what ended up being helpful, probably the single tool for affecting change in their lives is take deep breaths, break it down into baby steps. If you can't break it down into baby steps yourself, find somebody who can help you do it, because sometimes things are too complicated. You don't even know what the baby steps would be. And that ends up being incredibly effective because you're not overwhelmed. I agree completely. What else you got?
Well,
let me give out the phone number first. Before you do this, I just want to make sure. Anybody who's listening has been listening to the show and want to comment on the various suggestions for how to enhance the meaning of life that we've been sharing, we invite you to call. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And I'll also broaden it. I always like to make sure there's time to do what are called workovers. If you or someone you love is struggling with a work problem, you can call in and you'll get two for the price of one. Barbara and I are here to help you with that.
Price. No, Barbara and me.
Barbara and me are here?
Oh, no. Barbara and I are here.
Yeah, right. Barbara and I are here.
You can call Barbara and me.
Right. At the end of the sentence, if it's the predicate of the sentence, it's Barbara and me. If it's the subject of the sentence, it's Barbara and I.
So, I thought it was you take out the other person. So you say, you can call me. You wouldn't say you can call I.
Exactly.
But you would also say, I am here.
Right. Exactly.
It's just,
we're both saying the same thing in a different way. So Barbara and I are here to help you with any of your work-related problems. You can call Barbara and me.
Good job.
Right. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, KELW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And so let's go right back to the phones before we turn back to your quotes from these people and the meaning of life. Welcome to Work with Marty and Barbara. It is your turn on the air. What's on your mind?
Hey, how are you? Good morning, sir.
I'm well. Thanks for the call. How can we help, or what do you have to tell us?
Work-related problem. I just actually switched jobs. Starting in a new environment, it's always difficult for me. I was a top producer in my last role. And this is more of a startup kind of organization where I come from a big company.
Right.
What are your thoughts in someone that's kind of switching their environment and coming into a place where it's all new? You talked a little bit about baby steps. What do you like to see when you first go jump into a new environment? How do you deal with things?
Great. Barbara, I've been talking. I have a lot to say about this, but I also feel like I've been talking more than 50% of the time lately. Do you want to?
No, that's okay. You start, and then I'll chime in.
Great. This is something I learned from my career counseling practice. Believe it or not, had it start with college presidents. And so I've learned, and they rotate a lot. They go in and out of school at colleges all the time. And one of the things that I learned from them is that when you're in a new job, especially in a new field, the best thing you can do is set up 10 or 15 minutes to talk with all of your key stakeholders one-on-one privately and bring in a memo pad or an 8x11 notebook or an iPad or whatever and ask them, say, I'm new, I want to get off to a good start. What should I know that wouldn't appear in the employee handbook that is relevant to me, particularly in my new role? I'm really eager to learn. I know there's an institutional culture. Asking questions like that and meeting one-on-one is a great way to avoid the minefields that exist in any organization and also, more positively, get you off on the right foot as well as build relationships and make you not seem like an egotist. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. I appreciate the call.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds like it was enough. Thank you very much. Let's go back. Let's go right to the phones again. Welcome to work. Oh, Barbara, did you want to add anything to that?
I would also ask them, what's going well for you and what isn't going so well, and what would you do to change that?
That might be for a first meeting, maybe they may not be quite willing to open to bear their dirty laundry about what's not going so well. So that may be for a great question to ask for deep when you're trying to deepen the relationship later. Does that make sense?
Perhaps, but most people love to talk about themselves, love to talk about their perspective, and so I think you will find 90% of the people are willing to open up and tell you what they think is not going so well as what is.
Fair point. I agree. Let's go back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. What is on your mind? Hi, it's your turn. Hello, are you there?
Hello.
Hi.
Am I on?
You are.
Oh, okay. First thing, Marty and Barbara, Marty, you are the luckiest man in the world to be with a smart woman like that. Okay.
Oh, I like you.
Okay, the next thing is history of the world. There was a Monty Python movie by the same name, and I would encourage everyone to go watch that movie. Or what was it called? The name of your book that you've been promoting.
The Meaning of Life.
The Meaning of Life. There's a Monty Python movie by that name. It came out, 30 years ago? Anyway, I didn't call about that. Now, I drove a cab for a while, and I'm sitting here watching NASCAR. What's the difference? They should put two or three people in the car, as passengers. I mean, I don't know. I mean, for a profession, whatever. There's another thing. I want to know what Dr. Bakey ate, and I want to know what drugs he took, prescription and otherwise. How in the heck was he at such a high level of performance for all those years? And here's the other thing that Barbara questioned. Listen, I don't want an operation from a doctor that's only been sleeping 4 hours. But the other thing is, he was working in a hospital that had quality control. And I knew about Dr. Bakey. I heard about him when I was 11 years old, when he did the first heart transplant.
Right.
I've known about him that long. You are fine to mention him as a role model of working into old age.
Right. So let me answer the core question.
I wanted to ask you about my odd job career, but
Stay on the line. Hold on a second. We're going to hear about your odd job career in a minute. But first, in terms of longevity, everybody in the end, there is, some of it is we're just subject to our genetics, and we either win or lose in the genetic lottery about in vitality and health. But beyond that, we have a measure of control, and that actually the word control is key. If you can find a way in your work life to have a measure of control and not be a marionette, that reduces stress more than anything, because when you don't have control and everybody has power over you, that tends to increase stress and therefore take its toll on cortisol release and otherwise aging you. So to whatever extent you can establish autonomy, that's helpful. Of course, then it's the basic. You made two mentions of the used drugs. What drugs did he take? I really, really believe, and I did a review of the literature, a serious review of the literature for Time magazine a few months ago, marijuana. I used to be, neutral to it or whatever. And I know that there is a massive nationwide movement to legalize marijuana.
Oh, yeah.
But the medical, the really substantive, objective studies from Harvard and Northwestern and Stanford, especially in the last 2 years as the legalization movement has accelerated, it has accelerated the amount of funding for what actually effects marijuana has. It shows marijuana use not only has tremendous effects, especially started as a teenager, on both cognitive functioning, emotional health, etc., but it absolutely is related to causality, to causing cancer and heart disease to a far greater extent than we thought. So I would bet anything that Dr. Bakey did not use marijuana much, if at all, or any other drugs, including alcohol or tobacco. And
I didn't intimate that. What is his diet?
But we know he was thin.
Was he on actual heart medication? I mean, how did he live so long and be so high functioning?
Well, like I said, some of it is genetic, but he was very thin. He was never heavy. One of the few things we know for sure is that being overweight is highly causal of decrements in longevity. Being thin is the most important thing. Not smoking, not drinking to excess, not doing drugs to excess, staying thin, controlling stress, and putting yourself in work environments in which you have some measure of control and or a boss who is benevolent, and work you can feel ethical about, and then taking breaks. The more recent evidence suggests that getting up, now remember, as a heart surgeon, he was not sitting all day. It is very dangerous. They say sitting is the new cancer. If you are sitting more than about 8 hours, sitting for more than 8 hours a day, you are greatly increasing your risk, especially of cardiovascular problems. So getting up 5 minutes out of every hour, and Dr. DeBakey, because he was a surgeon and was standing much of the time, did not have that sitting sickness. So the last piece of the equation, inferring, I obviously don't know, for what Dr. DeBakey did, would be to make your rule, and it's my new rule of thumb over the last 6 months, I am out of that, because I all day I'm seeing clients, and I'm writing, and I'm doing radio shows or whatever, that's all sitting. I make a point of being out of, no matter what, getting out of my chair for 5 minutes out of every hour, and playing with the dog, taking a hike, cleaning the toilets, whatever it is I have to do, so that I am not sitting all the time. That, to me, is good a prescription for long life and health and vitality. And I'm not a kid myself. I'll be 65 in June, and I absolutely have every bit as much energy as I had when I was 30. And so that's my...
You're a liar. No, I'm sorry. I meant that as a joke.
Okay. I swear on my mother's life, that's the truth. Anyway, thank you for the call. Hopefully that's helpful.
Oh, okay, one more thing. I ride my bike every day. I'm 60 years old myself. I used to have one of those high-functioning jobs where I had some control. I worked for Rogers Bottling in Vallejo. I was quality control. Okay, bye.
No, did you wanted to ask me about your odd jobs thing, by the way. Did you want to ask me about that, or are you gone? He's gone. We gave him a fair amount of time anyway. Barbara, do you have any reactions? You know, you also, you're over 50, and you are very healthy. Anything that you would add to my equation about how to stay healthy, especially in your work life?
I think the more you're involved in your work life and the more you're trying to get better all the time and do good things, the younger you stay.
Yes, involvement. When you feel irrelevant, you feel that you can get depressed and then more likely to get involved in drugs and eating too much and the like. So, yes, being busy, feeling relevant, whether it be paid work or volunteer work, I really do believe is key to, you know, or helping other, you know, a family member. I was denigrating the centrality of family always for people. But if you have a family member who's not one of those ne'er-do-wells who are, you're going to waste all your time, it's not going to do any good. But if you have, let's say, a young adult, a young person who is failing to launch, not really, he or she may not be perfect, but he's a reasonable person, but just like so many college graduates, or even especially non-college graduates, are having a hard time finding a job, mentoring that kid, helping him to launch, encouraging him, teaching him some things, that can add so much happiness to you so that you're not going to get depressed. You'll feel relevant even though you're not getting paid.
Well, remember, anything that puts you into frequent contact with people and the more relationships you have, the healthier you're going to be mentally, and that translates to physically.
There's a correlation-causation problem there. People who are with people more generally are healthier. If somebody is unhealthy, let's say cognitively or physically, they're in decline, they're embarrassed, and they don't want to spend time with people, or they're not feeling up to it. So it's unclear whether being with people causes you to be healthier, or healthier people choose to be with more people.
I know if I were not, when I go to work, I interact with lots of people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
If I were retired and sitting at home, I would see far fewer people.
Yep.
And then I would be home, so I'd have nothing to do, so I'd eat a whole lot more. And then I'd gain weight, and so I wouldn't look good, and then I would be less inclined to go meet people. So I think that when you are able to stay working and feel like you're making a contribution, that's a really good thing.
I agree. Now let's turn back to you, Barb. So for those of you just joining us, you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco. Esquire magazine published a wonderful two-volume set called The Meaning of Life, in which they interviewed over 100 people and then put their best little nuggets in a book. And so who's the next one, Barbara, that you want to quote from?
Well, this is a guy that I had never heard of. His name is Chuck Close. He's an artist.
Right.
Who in 1988 suffered a spinal blood clot and ended up a quadriplegic.
I didn't know they had spinal blood clots. Jesus.
Well, that's what it says in the book.
I believe it. I just didn't know it. Go ahead.
He continued painting in a different style, obviously. And he says, inspiration is highly overrated. If you sit around and wait for the clouds to part, it's not liable to ever happen. Mm. More often than not, work is salvation.
I have nothing to add. I couldn't say it better myself. Is there anything you want to add to that? That's the quote. Anything you want to add, or you want to go to your next quote?
No, I really like that.
I think
work is a wonderful thing, no matter what your circumstances are.
I also like the first part of it the best. That even if you're waiting for the clouds to part, you're going to be waiting for Godot. There's always a reason to be sad, or things aren't quite right, you're not feeling the motivation. And that's where your earlier point about the baby steps matters. You're feeling overwhelmed, you're feeling it's too hard, you're stuck. In the end, it does come down to not procrastinating getting the burrito, but going and doing the baby step thing. What's your next quote, Barb?
Here's one from George Foreman.
Okay, the famous boxer. And I guess now who makes...
And picture of George Foreman grills.
Panini makers and the like, yes. Okay, go ahead.
He says, changing your nature is the hardest thing to do, but I discovered that you can be who you choose to be.
Hmm. Comment on
and
that?
And I really like that.
Say more. So how have you changed? And again, dear listeners, this is not about, you know, focusing on Barbara Nemco, the person. We're looking for generalizable principles, but Barbara knows herself better than anybody else. How have you changed in your life, and in what way have you changed, and what lesson might that have for our listeners in terms of change?
People will be surprised when I say I'm a very shy person. Mm-hmm. They usually laugh at me because I've changed that. My nature is to be very, very
yep.
shy. But that doesn't serve me well in the real world. So I've had to overcome that and to figure out how to reach out and not wait for somebody to knock on my door. And that was my whole childhood, being shy and not... I had friends, but I didn't have... I was not part of the popular group because I never put myself out there. And I didn't figure that out until my 30th high school reunion.
Of course.
I realized that if I had only joined something, I would have had all these other friends.
So you have the $64,000 question. I'm sorry.
There are all kinds of self-help books that can give you ideas for ways in which you can change the thing that you need to change. For me, one of the best books ever, and I know you've talked about this book before, you probably had her on the show, but Susan Rowain's How to Work a Room.
Right.
For shy people, that should be the Bible. That's the book that you can pull out before you go to any cocktail party, any family gathering, anything where there's a large crowd of people, a conference. This gives you the lines, the words that you can use to start a conversation with anybody, anywhere, and it's amazing how powerful that can be.
Yes, and for those, you know, I always hate when I listen to radio shows and they mention a book, and I know I'm not going to go read the book. Here is she was on the show, and I do recall some of the things she said. The key thing to starting a conversation is what's called having an environment, two things. One is coming prepared with a story or something that you're ready to tell at the right moment to the right person. The other thing is to start the conversation with what she calls an environmental comment, which is something about the event or the room, you know, the weather that's there, the food, the entertainment that's about to come on, the speaker who's going to be speaking, asking about, you know, why you're at the, you know, this is my first time at this conference. Something related to the environment is something that's a safe start way to start. And what really she taught me, which I didn't realize before, I used to dismiss small talk as silly. It really is the necessary initial steps for most people so they feel comfortable enough that they're going to want to go deeper. Spending a little time with the small talk is really well worth it. That's my summary of her book. Is there something you remember that has helped you that I have left out?
Yes. She talks about your attitude, that you walk in with the idea that you're going to have fun, without worrying about what people are going to think about you. And she says the best way to overcome your own self-consciousness is to make it your job to make sure that other people feel comfortable. And I used that once. I was invited to the wedding of a child of a friend of mine in New York. So I'm the only person I know at this wedding aside from the mother of the groom, and she's busy. So I walk into this room, and there are all these people, and I don't know any of them, and there's no reason I would know any of them. And I normally would tend to shrink into a corner, but I looked around for somebody who was standing by herself, and I walked over to her, and I said, "Hi, I'm Barbara Nemco. I'm an old friend of Sheila's. Who are you and what's your relationship to this wedding? And we started a conversation and had a lovely afternoon, and then she knew some other people, and so I met them, and I had one of the best times ever.
And that really, of course, has application for going to professional conferences, meetings within your, you know, when they have meetings, staff meetings, or get-togethers or picnics or parties. Great. Barbara, do you want to share more, you know, some other person who is quoted in the Meaning of Life book, or do you want me to?
Well, here's one from Donald Trump, interestingly.
Okay.
He says, my children have shown me that they're willing to work hard to become successful. That's very important, because when children grow up in wealth, you always have doubts.
Mm. Yep.
Now, for most of us, that's not terribly relevant, but I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, the question about the work thing, you know, again, I always like presenting other sides just so we have a more full-dimension discussion. I have seen many people who work their guts out and get nothing. You know, we keep saying, work hard, work hard, work hard. And, of course, Donald Trump and all these famous people work hard and they reap the rewards. But I have a big place in my heart for the hard worker who's still really struggling. What, for people, you know, people who listen to the show tend to not be 20. They're 30, 40, 50, 60, 70. And some of them may have worked hard their whole life and are still struggling. And they hear this show talking about the importance of hard work with Donald Trump telling his kids, and they're feeling dispirited. What would you say to those people who have worked hard and it has not paid off? Do they, to keep them from giving up, or would you say give up? And what would you really tell them?
I would say look around at the people who have the jobs that you would want. What do they have that you don't have? Or what have they done that you aren't doing? Or what have they learned that you need to learn in order to get ready for that job? Because people change and jobs change and people move and there are always opportunities, but you need to be prepared in advance for them. It's too late when it's the opportunity is available and you haven't taken that extra class or learned that extra skill. And with the world changing as rapidly as it is, and the technology changing as rapidly as it is, are you keeping up? Are you relevant?
What about the reality that, in which we don't like to talk about, it's not happy talk, American happy talk, half of people by definition are below average in intelligence, below average in drive, below average in technical aptitude, which today we're in such an ever more technical world. And so sometimes, you know, you can look at people and whatever, but you're feeling like you're simply one of the half of the 338 million people in America who's below average. What does a person say to him or herself when they're literally one of that bottom half?
I think you do what you can to try to improve. Below average, there are many meanings of what below average is. Sometimes below average is you just haven't put yourself in the right places, or you haven't had the confidence to try harder, or you haven't had the confidence to go for it, or you haven't kept up. You are who you choose to be within some limitations. Obviously, your native intelligence is may have some set some limitations, but they're talking about the brain continually being able to learn even as we're older. So don't assume that because you haven't been able to do it until now that it's totally impossible.
I tend to agree, and again, just a little more balance to it. Sometimes self-acceptance is key. If you have struggled and struggled and struggled to succeed in whatever spheres you've tried and you haven't, maybe because of those very foundational things, you're just not that bright or you're not that driven or whatever, you've got, God forbid, a physical ailment or a mental ailment. Maybe it is time to realize that all work is worthy work and downscale to where you can succeed. I swear that if I had no other alternative and I had my only job was to be to work at Popeye's chicken fast food place, I would take that job. And there, no matter how unintelligent and not driven I were, I could still do an artisan level job of being as good as I could be with the customers to make sure the chicken and the biscuits were as good as they could be. It's accepting in some senses after a while one's limitations and finding a job where you clearly can succeed. We have only a few seconds left. Barbara, any reaction to that?
Yeah, I'm not one at just accepting. I think what I would rather do is talk to other people, friends, colleagues, and say, why do you think I haven't been able to X, whatever it is
good.
That you want? And then and say, please be honest with me
good.
Because I'm asking so that I can make a change.
Great. Well, you know, like the caller said that I'm lucky to have you. I was, of course, offended that he didn't say you were lucky to have me, but such is the I certainly...
Oh, that goes without saying.
Right, yeah, yeah. But your last comment, certainly I agree with 100%, with no buts. And so that's a great note for us to say that is Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco for this week. The book, again, The Meaning of Life, is a two-book series. It's not brand new, so you may need to find it used. It may be hard to find in a bookstore, but on Amazon they definitely have it, and I really commend that series to you. Anyway, my thanks to my board operator, David La Tulipe, and of course all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do workovers on callers, and I'll talk with Dennis Yang. He is the CEO of Udemy.com on the present and future of online education for your career. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemco for Barbara Nemco, reminding you that we do find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
For the archive of Dr. Marty Nemco's articles, information on his 7 books, including How to Do Life, What They Didn't Teach You in School, plus how you can consult privately with Marty, go to martynemco.com. That's Marty, N-E-M-K-O.com. And join Marty again next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemco, right here on 91.7 KALW.